On this week's Bet the Process podcast, Rufus and I have a very special guest. We have Eno Saris, who is an OG baseball analyst slash writer. And we talk about some great things around ways that teams are looking for edges using training. We talk a little bit about Stuff Plus, and we talk about where you can find edges and even how you should build an organization that has applicable lessons outside of the world of sports. So with that, let's start the process.
Bet the process. Bet the process. Welcome to the podcast. Bet the process. It's not the typical cookie cutter nonsense. If you came just for picks, you're in the wrong place. Find a tout with the narrative to make a strong case. Instead of blindly assuming a team must be tanking, we're looking for the edge in Massey Peabody rankings. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line.
Welcome to another episode of the About the Process podcast. It's the post-masters edition. Did you see the numbers, Rufus, that the women's college basketball, the LSU, I don't know if it's the championship or the LSU-Iowa game.
Yeah, LSU,
one of those two games
LSU,
had
Iowa.
One of those games had twice as many. It might have been the championship.
No,
twice
no,
as
it would have been
Iowa-UConn,
maybe. Not Iowa-UConn? I don't know.
No, I think LSU-Iowa was very, very, very well watched, and I think that the championship was. Do you think that that's state of golf, or do you think that's like Scotty, or do you think that's just that people care a lot more about Caitlin Clark and women's basketball than they do about golf?
I mean, I think women's college basketball kind of really garnered a lot more attention this year than it has in the past. And I didn't realize this, but they were not allowed to have brackets, do bracket challenges for the women's tourney up until like a year or two ago. And so I, although it seems like if you look at the bracket, the chalk always wins in women's basketball. But I mean, I think it's great that it got so much attention.
Should we do a women's Calcutta next year?
I'm in.
Maybe we should. That'd be kind of be fun. How was your Masters? I kind of know anecdotally, it seemed pretty good.
Yeah, we did well in the Calcutta. We had a bad Masters for matchups overall. We had some bad breaks with the weather. I mean, predicting the weather was really tough. Like we were trying to forecast the delays, and then I mean, I ran my last simulation at like 6:30 a.m. when I had a better sense of when play would start. And so what ended up happening though was the guys that experienced the worst of the weather were people that I thought would probably experience the best of the weather on, let's say, Tuesday afternoon, because I thought that they would be getting to play some Saturday morning potentially, but play wasn't delayed enough. And you ended up having weather, a lot stronger wind on like late in the day Friday than was forecast initially. So that was tough. We lost a few matchups by like a stroke there pre-cut. Like you had Harmon like collapsing after being 3 under and then going like 9 over. And
how much do your projections change based on the weather? Like in a situation
amount.
Like that, like, yeah,
we're not talking like, I mean, on the margins, yes. Cause if you think about all it takes is in essence 0.1 strokes around to move a matchup 10 cents, a tournament matchup 10 cents or so. So like that's, and the weather effects oftentimes are a lot bigger than a 10th of a stroke around. So yeah, overall though, I think it was a good Masters. We had a small ROI before the Calcutta, but we did a lot of volume, and we ended up making up for the matchups being not great with outright stuff and sort of top five, top 10 stuff. We were really good on that. Like we hit Aubert, we had Cam Young, we had Morikawa. Basically, we were good on the tails, which is not normally what I'm normally better in the meat of the distribution, but this particular tournament, the guys I was really high on ended up, those guys ended up at the top of the leaderboard. So, you know, if only Morikawa had won, it would have been like freaking amazing, because we had a ton to win a ton on him, but Scheffler was a good consolation prize.
All right. We should probably talk a little bit about the Splash Sports contest that created what has been tabbed Overlay Gate. Michael Lewis has asked us for the rights to write about this. or Ben Mezrich, we're actually auctioning it to both of them.
I think we sold it for $45,000.
I think we would be remiss in not apologizing for the way that it was marketed. Obviously, it was not an overlay. Many times we answered that when asked on Twitter. I think the lesson for us is be careful in how we market things, to be very succinct around how we do it. And again, we apologize. Rufus has already made some offers on Twitter. I think our plan is to talk to Splash, who will be doing contests with them for all of the majors, and talk a little bit about something that we can do for the next one, which potentially will have an overlay or potentially will have prize money, or maybe we can give some free entries to the people that entered this contest. But we will talk about it, and we will announce that specifically once we've had a chance to talk to them. But, you know, I think most of you guys that know us know we're not trying to mislead anyone. We're really just trying to help a sponsor that helps fund this podcast promote contests and grow. And what we think are fun contests. I mean, I thought the March Madness Survivor one we did, which someone we know very well happened to win and won a fair amount of money. I think that one was really fun. The golf one was challenging because I was in Hawaii and I had someone remotely kind of enter for me. That was harder for sure. But you know, what do you think? Cause I was trying to think about it. What do you think would be the best like kind of game for a golf tournament? Because the problem with golf is that because so few people are in contention that you can be like kind of out of it. So I know that like Splash Sports allowed us to drop a golfer with the worst score from these kind of tiers concept. But I was wondering if there's something that you could do every day that would, you know, get you involved.
Daily contests?
And have, yes. Well, I was thinking like
is a survivor
some kind
type
of like,
thing.
Yeah. Is there some kind of survivor type thing that you could do, which would be like under over par or something. And then, you know, I don't know. Like I wasn't able to do it. I had a 6-hour flight home from Hawaii and I couldn't figure it out, but I was trying to think of like game design, if there would be a fun, you know, game design. I mean, obviously, Matt, I've never found like a perfect golf, like betting construct or pool concept. The Calcutta is so perfect. Everything else I've done is like pretty meh from that standpoint. Obviously, like the tiers thing that Splash had, I thought was pretty interesting. But like, you know, again, like you're picking five golfers and hoping that they're in contention at the end. Like you want to have a sweat all the way into that last day. Whereas like, I think betting sports period, you end up with sweats because you can sort of bet on each game. But like golf, it seems harder. I guess you could try to do something every day. I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
I agree that the Calcutta sweat, especially this year, it's a lot of fun.
Well, because you have so much of the
DFS golf. DFS golf is actually a pretty good structure, I would say. I mean, I personally hated it because it felt like I was rooting on or against everybody on every single shot. But I think that's kind of what you want in a way. And you feel the same way with the Calcutta. Like, if I don't own a golfer at the top of the leaderboard, I'm rooting against him.
What game format in DFS should I try? Because I'm curious about that. Like, what is the best one to do?
I would just say the regular, the main slate.
And it's like the broad,
like six golfers. You know, you get points per birdie, par. You lose points for bogeys. You get a bonus.
Yeah, I'm gonna try it.
If your guy has a bogey free round or three birdies in a row, and then you get points for finishing position. So, I mean, yeah. It is pretty entertaining. And so, you want to get everybody through. You want to get all six guys to make the cut. And then obviously we want the high upside too, but at the same time, like there is a little bit of a risk reward too, right? You go for the consistent guy that you think is more likely to make the cut, but doesn't have the upside, or the guy that you think has the upside, but you know, could just completely tank. But I think, yeah. Jeff, I want to say that I'm happy. I think Splash Sports is a great sponsor to have because I do really enjoy games like this. I think they're really fun. I don't think that they provide any sort of troubling conflict of interest type thing. It's essentially pari mutuel.
Except when you market it incorrectly.
Well, that's true.
Whatnot. So, okay, let's move on.
I'm sorry for my tweet. Jeff was like, you need a tweet promoting it. And I did, but it was not worded it was not worded very well. I should have thought about that, and I'm sorry.
Okay. You know, Saris coming on, you know, obviously is one of the top guys in terms of analyzing baseball from an analytical standpoint, been on the game for quite some time. And I think you guys will really enjoy this conversation. We don't do a lot of baseball here, but I think Rufus and I's first love in sports and analytics was baseball. So it's kind of fun to Definitely. Be able to geek out with him. So we'll talk to you guys all on the other side. We now welcome into the Bet the Process podcast, Eno Saris. We've never had Eno on. We don't actually get a chance to talk very much baseball. And I think for Rufus and I, this is special, obviously, because we've got one of the OG baseball people who's still doing it, right? We, you know, all the prospectus guys, I don't even know if they're still doing it anymore. Eno, welcome to Bet the Process podcast. You're driving right now. Where are you headed?
I'm headed to the ballpark. Going to try and talk to Lars Nootbaar and maybe Lawrence Butler. I've got a couple things on my sheet. Maybe something about bat speed. Working on something about bat speed.
Is that the new the pioneer now? Is like instead of exit velocity or instead of spin rate, we're going to be talking about bat speed as the next thing?
Yeah, pretty much. If you look at the top guys in expected weighted on base average, so just expected production last year, they all had what you would call in scouting grades 50 bat speed or better. So they all had above average bat speed. It's the easiest way to hit the ball hard is to swing the bat fast. But there are a lot of people in baseball that are kind of resistant to that idea. They say, oh, it's how you get the bat speed, or it's how quickly you get the bat up to speed, or it's this, or it's that. There's also, you know, there's kind of like the driveline guys who are like, no, bat speed, get trained for bat speed, do that, it's good.
So you wrote an article recently that I found very interesting about. It was about contact hitters, like Stephen Kwan, adding more power. And it made me think of golf, where you've sort of seen this revolution now with golfers like Matthew Fitzpatrick famously added distance. He trained to hit the ball further and he won the US Open. And then just recently, this guy, Steven Yeager, kind of did the same thing. He driving distance had been a weak point for him. He added length. He just won, what was it? The Valero Texas Open, I guess it was. And so, and I asked our friend Corey Jez whether it was easier to... Is it easier for somebody, a golfer, I guess, to add distance or to like get better putting, or right? And so I think that the parallel in baseball, sorry, this is long-winded, but the parallel here is, what is actually, is it easier for a contact hitter to add more power or for a power hitter to cut down on the strikeouts? And you talk about this in your article, but I'm curious, like, what does the data say on this?
Yeah, I mean, the data, I haven't seen like a study that really locks this down, but I will tell you this, that like, over time, due to aging curves, one thing that you do see is that hitters hit fewer ground balls as they age. So that's like sort of a natural process of adding power. So if you start with somebody who can make contact but hits a little bit too many ground balls, then you might see them just naturally, according to the aging curve, start to hit more fly balls as they mature. But you know, I also just think anecdotally, you know, it's supported by the fact that, you know, we have training methods for adding power. I have not really seen a great method for adding contact. In terms of adding power, you can take these things called weighted bats. We've had weighted balls in baseball for a while that have allowed people to throw harder on the mound. And so weighted bats is a similar thing where you're swinging the implement that you're going to use in the game, but you use really heavy ones and you use really light ones. It's similar to how sprinters will sprint downhill to get used to running really fast, but they'll also sprint uphill to make it harder on themselves or sprint with parachutes behind them. So it's the idea of doing the thing that you would normally do, but doing it with variable instruments, heavier instruments or in more difficult ways. So I think from a training perspective, yes, it's definitely easier to add power than to add contact.
So do you think there's any inefficiencies in terms of organization building that teams are doing Or put another way, what would, I guess, if you were building an organization from the ground up, what would you be focused on in terms of which type of players you would get and how you'd try to develop them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an inefficiency. And, you know, I spent like a week with a team, and I kept talking about bat speed, and different members of the team were kind of like, oh, no, you know, you can't cheat to get the bat speed. That would be bad. Or bat speed is correlated with swing and miss, which is actually just a failure of the study, I think, because bat speed allows you to swing and miss more. You know, it's a selection bias thing. If you hit the ball hard when you hit it, then you can miss more. that baseball will let you stay in the game longer because you hit home runs when you hit it. In any case, I found a lot of resistance internally from teams about this idea that, can we just say that bat speed is good? Like, just saying something simple like that, I got a lot of resistance. And so I know that, for example, the Red Sox hired Jason Ochart from Driveline. And one of his big things is, take everybody you've got that has a good contact rate, is a good contact hitter with good plate discipline, and put them on a weighted bat scheme just to see if you can up their bat speed and get power that way. And that's kind of what the Red Sox are doing now. They've done it with David Hamilton, who's now their starting shortstop due to injuries, and they've done it with a few other of their players that are coming up through the ranks. Roman Anthony is another one who's now a top prospect due to the power that he got from this weighted bat program that he did. So if one team is doing it, I can't say that they're the only team doing it, but just knowing that I've met resistance from teams internally, I would say that, you know, it's probably on the level of 3 to 5 teams are doing it, and the other 25 have no idea anything about it.
Is there any danger to a guy kind of losing what got him there in the first place? So, I mean, I guess meaning like you still want to keep the fundamentals of your swing, and if you can keep the same fundamentals but swing harder, that's great. But if you have to change the fundamentals, then suddenly is there a danger of sort of losing like the contact skill you had that made you good in the first place?
Yeah, I think there might be a fundamental discussion here that's similar to what you've seen on the pitching side. They've debated in pitching whether or not command is a skill, how sticky it is year to year, and how much of a spread there is in the command skill. And I think with pitching, most baseball teams have decided that stuff is what they want. Command is that there's not that much variability, and it isn't that sticky. And so they're chasing stuff. On the hitting side, I guess you could make a correlation between bat-to-ball skills being sort of like command, but the guys who demonstrate bat-to-ball skills do it year in and year out. And so what I would say is, even if you sacrifice a little bit of that bat-to-ball skill off an elite guy, the power gains are usually worth it. One thing you'll see is that slugging is now correlated to team success better than on-base percentage. And so teams are chasing slugging. You want to have a slugger at every position on the diamond now. And so if I'm a young hitter, like even a Stephen Kwan or Jackson Merrill, two of the guys I highlighted today, if I am a guy that makes a lot of contact and somebody tells me maybe you could trade a little bit of that contact for more power, I'm listening.
Do you think that's universally true? Regardless of the environment, you want power hitters everywhere? And look at what the Orioles did with left field back. You know, they put that back because they were trying to compete in the AL East, and they didn't have a ton of power hitters, and they felt like they could win with younger, they could have an advantage in terms of outfield defense. And I mean, I'm sure Ryan Mountcastle doesn't like it, but
yeah.
Are there ways for teams to sort of game that in a way and design their, are there fundamental team designs that can work that are not all slugging?
I think what Rufus is asking is how universal is the idea of a slugging being correlated and causal to winning?
Yeah. No, the flip side is this. Contact rates in the postseason are more predictive than they are during the regular season of team success. So there is a separator where if you can hit with power and have more contact with the team, you can separate yourselves from the teams that, like the Twins, are a high swing and miss, high power team. They've had a harder time in the playoffs than the Astros, who have a little bit less power but a lot more contact. And well, that's been kind of, yeah.
Well, is that because of who they're facing in the postseason? Whereas you're basically getting like all the high leverage guys and you're getting starting pitchers not going through the order a third time necessarily, et cetera.
Yes, because at the upper ends of velocity, contact matters more. You know, because at the upper ends of velocity, you do want to have to bat the ball skill to put that ball in play. So, yes, I can't say that it's universally like I want to load up with sluggers that miss the ball a lot. That's not necessarily true. But if I do have an elite contact rate hitter, you know, I do want to explore adding power to it. So, it's, I also think about like the Marlins and the Giants. They have these big parks and, power doesn't always play the same in those parks. And so you've seen Kim Ng, who was running the team last year, when she came in with the Marlins, she said, we need to make more contact. She tried, added Luis Arraez, and, they got to the postseason. But there's also this, if you just say, okay, we're going to do things totally differently and we're going to chase contact here because we're in Miami, you can't do that universally. Because what if you're in the draft and you pass on a guy who might hit, you pass on the next Giancarlo Stanton because he misses the ball too much. So you can't go whole hog into any one thing if you want to be open to opportunities from other places. So that's one reason why you've seen teams actually make their parks more vanilla, because they want to be open. They like the Giants want an old slugger to feel, and JD Martinez this year said no to the Giants, said yes to the Mets. They want San Francisco to be a place where an old slugger, if he wants to sign for cheap, will do it, and so they haven't managed that yet, but they've been trying to make their park more vanilla, more normal, and that's part of the thing. That if you want to chase an edge in baseball, you want to chase an edge with 1 foot still in the fundamentals, I think. Because you don't want to lose out on somebody just because you're trying to make a team of go-go speedsters that makes a bunch of contact. That you're not going to pass on Giancarlo Stanton in the draft, So you kind of still have to keep one eye on the fundamentals.
Well, the good news is the guys you draft are your indentured servants for six years in baseball, in Major League Baseball. So they don't have a lot of choices, right?
Yeah, that's right. And if you did get the next stand, you can trade them if you want it.
Yeah.
I want to talk a teeny bit about like this, what we're talking about here, because the indentured servant thing is actually very interesting, right? Ultimately, we had Kyle Bodie on here, and we've huge fans of Driveline and obviously friends fans of what Breslau is doing in Boston. But I had a this area.
Don't forget
Sig
in Baltimore. Come on.
Well, we're talking a little bit about a theme here. We're not just talking about all the people we're fans of. We're talking about a theme. And the theme is this idea. This theme is this idea that Michael Lewis and, Billy Beane or rather Billy Beane lived in this world where he didn't really believe in like player development. It seems like this world is now becoming a lot of player development being the big opportunity. So do you see that increasing, like the drive lines getting hired by the Red Sox, and is that the area, and where do you see that going, and is that at the risk of what's happening in places like Tampa, where we're seeing a lot of pitcher injuries, or is that more just anecdotal and small sample size?
Well, I'm going to separate out the two questions a little bit that I hear. One is that player development, I think, is absolutely still an edge for teams. The teams that do it well are doing better than other teams, and the teams that invest in it are still doing better. And I don't understand why. I guess I do understand. The reason why that it's still an edge and it's still a place that some teams choose not to invest is that it's really hard to see the results sometimes. And, you put this money in and you're hoping – the process will get better, but people get judged in baseball too quickly, a year or two or 3 years. And player development is really complicated because scouting is part of it. The players you put into the machine, that's really a big part of it. You have to know how good they are before you put them through the processes you put them through. You have to know that the processes you put them through work, and then you have to know that the process that the player on the outside of this process on the end of it, when you've developed him, quote unquote, is you don't have to know how good he is there. So there's a lot of noise in trying to decide how good he is before, how good these things are you're doing for him, and how good he is after. So in that noise, you get somebody fired. Like Chaim Bloom, I think, was doing a fairly good job in Boston of creating a process that was developing young hitters. You're seeing some of the young hitters that he developed now in the big leagues, and they have some good ones at the top of the minors. So he was doing some good stuff, but it wasn't quick enough, you know. And so, you know, off he goes. And so I think with other teams, you see, oh, do I invest in scouting and maybe get some high level prospects really quickly? Do I invest in free agency and make my major league team better really quickly? Or do I invest in this nebulous process called player development that may take 3 or 4 years to really figure out? You have, like, you know, 150 coaches in the minor league level. I got to fire half of these guys and find, you know, 75 new coaches in the next 2 years in order to make this process better. So it's a difficult thing. It takes a lot of thinking. Another thing is, you know, credit is a really tough thing. Every minor league hitting coach wants to be like, oh, I changed O'Neill Cruz. He's the reason why I'm the reason why he's good. And you want to know who's doing good work, but that sort of asking for credit goes against, like, sort of the organizational philosophy that we're all working together. So that's one thing. Player development is hard. That's why it's still an edge. B, does it lead to injury? Does it lead to weird things? That's what you're talking about, sort of the indentured servitude. Does it lead to weird things where the team incentive is different than the player incentive? And so the team incentive is, what if I just create a mill of players where, you know, everybody comes up through my system throwing 97 and they all get TJ 2 years into the major league. But you get that feeling a little bit in Tampa where they just keep running through arms. They just have tons and tons of arms, and they always at the top of the stuff leaderboards. They always have the best stuff, and they're always hurt. And they seem okay with it because they just have more pitchers than everybody else seems. That's a little bit ugly. I don't like that part of it. And I would just say this, you're taking away some of the agency of the players when you talk about it this way. Because if you ask a player, I'll hear players say, I'd rather have TJ and make the big league than not have TJ and not make the big league. And the players themselves will say, you know, I thought about this, and I've decided to throw at the upper ends of my reaches, throw as hard as I can, because I want to make the big leagues, and, you know, I care about making the big leagues, and I'm risking my health to do it, and I know that I'm doing it. So the players have some agency in this. They know what they're doing. There's no player development program that a team can really force you to do. You know, the player can still say no. The player can still be released. The player has some agency in the matter, even though you're right, they are indentured servitude, and there's a little whiff of nastiness about this whole thing.
Well, I think one issue here, right, is the misaligned incentives, where the players are not making money earlier in their career, where they can theoretically, like, have the most value, and because they have not had Tommy John surgery and you know, they make the big leagues, but there's no guarantee after that they're going to be the same. And so when they hit, once you get to free agency, I mean, you might not even make it to free agency. And so the teams are trying, the team's goal is to win now. And do you see this being an issue with the bat speed stuff too? Like we've talked about, it's been discussed ad nauseum in the media about pitcher injuries, but you don't, are we going to see, if we start seeing guys try to swing harder and harder and harder, are we going to see more injuries to hitters?
It's possible. Oblique injuries are related to how fast you turn, and we've definitely seen an uptick in oblique injuries across baseball. So it's possible we're in the middle of it already. I don't think it'll lead to as many surgeries. It won't be 12-month surgeries and things like that. So, you know, I don't think it'll be the same exactly. There's something kind of unique about throwing the baseball and stress you put on your elbow that's different from hitting. And I think that this whole conversation we're having right now, a big part of what happened in the last collective bargaining agreement was that the MLB Players Association really focused on getting young players paid more and earlier. And so they did a lot of things where the minimum salary went up more than it's ever gone up before, They created a bonus pool for players that, you know, finish in the award listings and just play really well in their first season. There's just an effort on the Players Association in general to get more money up front when the players are playing well and not rely on that free agency aspect. So I would say that for, you know, most players, the difference is, do I make $30,000 in AAA or do I make $700,000 in the big league? And that's why you'll see players even spike their velocities when they get to the big league. They'll throw harder when they get to the big league because if they get TJ there, they get major league money. So, you know, that's definitely a dark joke that young pitchers make. But there's a big difference between 30 and 700,000. So there's still a big carrot for making the big league.
Well, yeah, and if they're injured, their service time clock is still ticking. So
exactly, yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit sort of on the projection front and the quantitative side. I mean, not super detailed, but how do you integrate, I guess, narratives and sort of qualitative information you hear around guys, which, I mean, look, this happens every year at this time, right? And spring training as well, like guys adding pitches, off-season workout programs, stuff that like wouldn't be factored into the Marcells or something, a basic rating system like that. Like, what's your process for trying to discern what is and isn't meaningful when it comes to information like that?
Well, you know, about half of the pitchers that say they're throwing a new pitch in spring actually take it all the way to the big league, to the regular season. So, you know, some of that I try to remain skeptical of. But, you know, I'm in the clubhouse. I'm talking to players directly. And there's nothing more sort of satisfying than having a player explain to you why they're good. You know, it's kind of intoxicating and makes you believe their story. And so I just have to kind of work against that. A lot of times the cold, hard numbers are a good way to do that. But I always add a subjective element when I make my rankings, where it's just, you know, whether or not I believe this person can add this pitch. The way that you can make it quantitative is, you know, I have this stuff metric that looks at the different shapes of your pitches. You know, I think one thing we haven't done yet in the public sector with that is to project what would happen if you added a pitch, and if you could project like what the shape of that pitch would be, what ideal pitches would be to add to an arsenal, you know, and the sort of likelihood that a pitcher might add that to an arsenal, like maybe some sort of idea of peak stuff or a range of stuff pluses that this pitcher could get to, you know, especially since they can arrange their pitches differently. The easiest way to change your stuff plus is to throw your high stuff plus pitches more often. So, you know, there could be some sort of optimized stuff plus or projected stuff plus that we could kind of incorporate some of those aspects of narrative. We can say, oh, hey, computer model, can you show me what it would be like if this guy threw a cutter? Because he's saying he's throwing a cutter. So just add a league average cutter to this arsenal and see what it does. And so there are some ways that we can take narrative and put them into the model that we're not doing, maybe some teams are doing.
I like that though. It's actually a process for doing it, sort of quantifying it simulating what it would look like.
Yeah, some teams are doing it because I know, for example, that the Dodgers, you know, they acquired a bunch of pitchers that had very similar fastball metrics to Evan Phillips. And Evan Phillips had a sweeper. And so the Dodgers acquired some of these guys to say, hey, try a sweeper. We think you have the right mechanics, you have the right fastball. You know, we think this is gonna happen. So there are teams that are sort of modeling, like, what are some undervalued players out there that we could, you know, draft or acquire and change their arsenal. So there must be some teams doing this because you'll see it happen in front of you. A team will trade for a guy and add a pitch right away, you know.
Well, and then there's also times when you see a team acquire someone and you look at their numbers in the majors and or minors and say, like, this doesn't make any sense unless there is something they see that this guy, like maybe, you know, high spin rate or whatever, basically something, he's got the physical skills, but isn't channeling it properly.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times they're featuring the wrong fastball. So sometimes it'll be as simple as, hey, let's just throw a sinker instead of this bad four seam that you've been throwing, or let's just ditch the four seam and the sinker entirely and throw a cutter. So, you know, a lot of things flow off the fastball. Even in our model, the fastball is an anchor off of which all the other pitches are defined. And so, you know, you can see how the model might actually have trouble with somebody who has three different fastballs. It doesn't know which one to anchor to. And so you could get ahead of even a Stuff Plus model by saying, man, if we anchor this guy to, like, that's what a projected Stuff Plus would do, right? Let's anchor this guy to his cutter instead of his four seam. What does his rest of his arsenal look like now? And they can do that kind of math. And that's one of the easiest ways that you'll see people change is to change the fastball they're throwing.
So in betting, and we are a betting podcast, like, you want to be early. So you want to get to, you want to identify something that the market isn't identifying before the market. The market eventually will either will come to your numbers, either because you were right or the market is right eventually. I'm not saying this well at all, but if you can get to something and realize that something is meaningful and add signal before the market does, there's huge potential. And that's how you win at betting, at least how I've won at betting, right? Like, I'll be early on a particular team and find value on them quite often. And then I'll either be correct or not correct, but, and that can be on a team basis or a player basis. So where, if you were betting on baseball, what would the opportunities to be sort of quote early on something be that you would look for?
Yeah. One of the interesting feelings is once you were early on something and you're winning on it, and then you realize that you have to get off because the lines have adjusted, and even though you were early on something, you still have to stop. You know,
you have to constantly reinvent yourself. You know, you have to find the next thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel that way because you know, Stuff Plus, I think, was a huge advancement in the betting sphere. I think there's probably still an edge there because Stuff Plus becomes valuable, you know, after one start. You start seeing signal from Stuff Plus after one start. And especially with fastballs, you can have 20 fastballs and know how good a guy's fastball is. So I think, you know, there's like a bunch of reliever situations that you can maybe do some prop bets on by looking at Stuff Plus. But even starting pitchers, especially like rookie starting pitchers, if you get one start of data, and now we're starting to have minor league numbers where I just tweeted out the top 10 minor league numbers for Stuff Plus that I have. So if you have that in hand, you could probably get ahead of a player's debut and know a little bit more than maybe the average bettor, and maybe even some of those betting houses, because Stuff Plus is still pretty much in its infancy. You know, what would look like, you know, what I'm looking for as this sort of like reinvention and the next phase for me is I want bat metrics. I want bat like swing path shape, bat attack angle. I want bat speed. I want directly measured bat speed. And I want to be able to start to model the batter hitter interaction using biometric analysis. And I know the very best teams are doing this. And I'm just hoping that StatCast and Savant allow us some of those metrics in the public sector so that, you know, the very first thing that we all kind of laugh at, I think, in most betting spheres is batter versus pitcher, where you say, oh, this guy's 3 for 10 off that guy. You know, he's got his number, you know, and you know, like, come on. And, you know, I don't think those have much value, but we might come all the way back around on the other end and say, well, batters with these biomechanical characteristics have a really hard time with pitchers with these shape characteristics. And so I'm going to bet against this batter. Or I'm going to put money on this guy's batter K prop, or I'm going to bet against this team because they all have this kind of biomechanical characteristic or whatever. So, you know, I don't think we're there yet, but that's what I'm chasing.
It's like the idea of, I mean, back in the book, you know, Tango, Lichman, Dolphin, the pitcher familias, you know, the certain types of pitchers versus certain types of hitters.
Yeah. Yeah. We can already do a little bit of something where like ground ball hitters against fly ball pitchers or whatever. Like, you know, there's certain matchups that definitely favor the pitcher or hitter. And like, this is just being more precise with it. This is saying, oh, guys who are handsy can do this, and guys who commit their hips early do this. And then we'll be able to, so I have stuff plus and location plus for pitchers. What I want to do is path plus, which is just, you know, the path and the swing speed, and then decision plus, which you've seen some good numbers out there. There's a number out there called Seager, which looks at hitters, not from a perspective of, you know, just don't swing at balls and swing at strikes, but do you swing at good strikes? Do you swing at balls that produce good outcomes? And do you not swing at those other pitches? We can refine that even further. We can say, do you swing at nasty pitches or do you not swing at nasty pitches? Because we have stuff plus. And so there's a little bit more that we can do with plate discipline. But in the end, I'll have path plus and eye plus maybe for hitters.
I think we're just getting more and more granular and trying to find the signal at an even more granular rate. The thing, what is this first thing that predicts this other thing that predicts this other thing? When's it ever going to stop, huh?
No, I don't know. And we're really fighting around the smallest, like we're fighting about decimal points. Like the stuff plus base projections that I use beat other projections when it comes to certain metrics, batting average on balls in play, homers, barrels, some of the stuff that we didn't think we could project that well in the past. We're starting to be able to project better using stuff plus. And I'm talking about, like, if you know RMSE, like root mean square error, like we're talking about 0.02 RMSE. Like that's what we're fighting over. And so there's all these different stuff metrics saying, I've got the better stuff metric. They're not even fighting over the 0.02. They're fighting over like the 0.002.
Right. It's some point, like the differences are going to be so small though. Like what are the things that nobody's really talking about quantifying that? I mean, for example, which guy's mental, I mean, when you draft a guy, you don't know his mental makeup. You're trying to figure that out. Right. I mean, in the NFL, you have the Wonderlic test that NFL prospects are given. Are there any sort of like haystacks that we just really haven't dived into quantitatively yet that where there could be a lot more alpha than just searching for that 0.0002?
Maybe. I know that like the Red Sox were doing some stuff with neuroscience and Mookie Betts. And, you know, the one problem is you're not going to really get approval from the players or get everybody that is draftable to like sit down and like play your computer game, so that you can figure out, you know, how quick their reaction time is in this like sort of neuroscience, you know, testing facility, you know, like that's just not going to happen. So I did talk to Will Carroll, the injury expert on Twitter, and he's got what he thinks is a test that beats the Wonderlic. And it's a little bit like it, but it's more about, you know, just makeup. You know, I think that's what we're chasing, the word makeup. I have thought that the scouts that can scout makeup are probably giving their organizations a lot of help. But, you know, just think about exploring that word makeup. Makeup is so weird. Is makeup, like, does a player have good makeup because he'll do whatever it takes to win, but he's also, like, a terrible person that might get arrested? You know, what does makeup mean there, you know? We have pretty really big examples of that in baseball, like over the last couple of years. And so, you know, do you want like makeup like he's not going to get arrested, or do you want the makeup he'll slit anyone's throat to get it done, you know? And and then there's makeup like you know, uncoachable. He's uncoachable. Well, maybe he's uncoachable because he's actually doing all the research himself. Everybody thinks that Tommy Pham has bad makeup. I am sorry, Tommy Pham, I believe when he tells me I make people around me better. Because all he does is research. He says he's his own hitting coach, and all he does is research what actually makes hitters better. So makeup is so hard to doubt. But it could be an edge. You know, there are sort of the neuroscience like ideas that like if you could get people to allow you to test them, you might be able to scout better, and you could be able to train better. I think VR it hasn't, like virtual reality hasn't crossed the gap where it tricks players into believing it's real, but it gets closer and closer to being a training environment that people could use. So there's some stuff there. If I knew it, I'd be working on it. So I'm working on what I can come up with, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a unique challenge for baseball because you're drafting players so young and you don't know how they're going to respond to adversity. You don't know what their work ethic's going to be like. You don't know what motivates them. And so I feel like, you know, you're trying to, and you don't know how they're going to develop physically also. So there's so much you're trying to predict there. But
yeah, very much so. And there's just, like I have kids, that, you know, I take them to the doctor and they, you know, they try to stress me out about where they are on the growth curves. And I'm like, dude, like I had puberty in high school, man. Like I was 5'2", 105 pounds when I hit high school. I was 6'2", 125 when I left. You know, so like I'm not stressed about my kids' growth curve, but they've got it on all the curves. And, you know, I'm sure every team has like, you know, some projections for what the body's going to end up with. But everybody, you know, kind of grows in leaps and bounds. So that's a big part of it. And then I think also like the interesting thing about baseball, and I'm not sure, I think it's probably all sports, is the growth of independent coaching. And so we've talked just on this podcast about how we like Driveline, we like Kyle Bodie, we like, you know, these places, you know, that just makes it really hard to know if you are kind of trying to study player development. And you want to say, oh, the Royals are bad at developing pitchers. What about Cole Reagan? Well, Cole Reagan went to Tread, which is like a Driveline. It's a data-driven facility. And so baseball players are not with the organization year-round. And so there's always 3 months of noise in any sort of attempt to study how baseball players grow, age, how they improve, how player development is good. They go somewhere else, and then they come back. And no matter how much you try to track what they're doing, you can't stay on top of it. You're not in charge when they're back in the Dominican. You know, it's like they're going to do whatever they're going to do. So there's a lot of sort of open questions around baseball, and I think that's true-ish to other sports, but, you know, maybe not to the same extent.
So I have one final question. As someone who's been in clubhouses a lot, do you think clubhouse chemistry matters?
I think on the edges, on the extremes, it does. I've been in some of the clubhouses that I've been in that were just absolutely terrible. Didn't win as well as, you know, people expected them to. I think of the Matt Harvey Mets. They didn't make it to the World Series, so it didn't matter that it was pretty toxic behind the scenes. But, you know, they didn't win at all. On the flip side, those Royals, I think they even beat those Mets. The Royals, they all came up through the minor leagues together. And there were some really strong bonds there. You know, like get your friend out of jail type bonds that weren't all reported. And so, you know, that kind of, I think going to work with people you like, it matters. Making that environment is really hard. So it's a little bit like, I can tell you the command probably matters, but coaching up command is hard and command can disappear. I feel the same way about clubhouse chemistry. Clubhouse chemistry matters, but you can't just sign a new player and say, okay, the new player, we hear he's really great in the clubhouse. That's going to fix everything. Because I think Curtis Granderson was on those Mets. And I love Curtis Granderson, and most clubhouses love Curtis Granderson. He was not able to change the entire clubhouse culture as like a, you know, a kind of a later career veteran. So, you know, I think it's just hard to change. It's something that exists and it's important, but it's hard to really affect.
Yeah. And to that end, where do you think these, the Baltimore Orioles of the last year or two rank in clubhouse chemistry?
Yeah, I mean, they got that same sort of Royals thing where, like, all these guys came up through the minor leagues together. They won together. They had shenanigans. You know, they did shenanigans together in the minor leagues when they were making, you know, $20,000 and living in a in a house with four or five of them at a time and going and drinking dollar beers at the local, bowling alley, So like, they know each other pretty well. And so I would assume that's like a benefit of maybe the tanking and getting a bunch of good players at the same time is that they kind of know each other that way. Another person I think of that's really important in this way, Corbin Carroll on the Arizona Diamondbacks, he signed a bigger contract than a lot of the people he was coming up with. But he said to me, I think that the clubhouse chemistry matters. And so I took all the young players out in the big league. I took them out to dinner like once a week. And I thought about chemistry as something that mattered to me and that it was something that I could actually do something about as a young leader in the clubhouse. And so sometimes I think the one thing you can do that's really, really important, the one thing that teams can really affect change and what really matters is who do you give the big contract to? The person who is paid the most in your clubhouse is the person that players will de facto look to, and it's usually it has to be a position player. So
James McCann.
But if you give all your money to Fernando Tatis and Manny Machado, that's saying something, And I think Manny's like to his benefit has been trying to like step into that leadership role. But, who you give all your money to really matters.
I mean, there's a difference between Adley Rutschman, who hopefully will get that money, and Manny Machado as an Orioles fan. I'll say that.
Yeah, I do think so. Manny, as much as he tried to, it wasn't something that came natural to him. And Fernando doesn't really have the sort of body language of a leader on the field, I would say. There might be different things going on behind the, but also he's made the poor decisions of a young kid that you wouldn't want to be a leader. I mean, just even getting on a motorcycle after you got $340 million, you're just kind of like, what are you doing, kid?
Awesome. All right, we got to let you go so you can get to the ballpark. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast, and maybe we'll try to get you on towards the end of the season when the playoffs are starting so we have some exciting playoff talk.
Yeah, and if anybody's listening, has a betting model, Stuff Plus is something that we would love to talk to you about. Putting into a DFS or a daily model is something that could be a really powerful addition to anybody's model. So if they want to talk to me, I'm at ENOSARRIS on Twitter. There's a couple easy ways to catch me, but that's an easy one too.
All right, ENOSARRIS at ENOSARRIS on Twitter. So, thank you. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So that was our interview with ENOSARRIS. I wrote down a few things, Rufus. The idea
during
that
the
player
interview
development is
what during that? The interview. You wrote down things during the interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, so did I.
Is that
in our shared
okay.
doc? Yeah, I did in our shared doc.
Down,
I guess you're hoarding the ideas yourself.
I wrote down Rufus has a lot of trouble articulating his thoughts in any concise manner. No, I actually didn't write that down. I wrote down player development is hard. That's why there's still an edge. And I think about this a lot in the world of blackjack and why, blackjack is this game that's not very hard to learn how to count cards. Again, like, let's say that I think I've said this on this podcast before, but let's say I was the best card counter in the world, which I'm not, but let's just say I was, I'd still only be marginally better than the next best card counter in the world because it's a very solved thing and it's very easy to understand. Whereas player development, as Eno was saying, is very hard. You got to invest time. You also have to have a long-term perspective. These are all things that are hard for human beings to do. And for that reason, there's still an advantage if you're willing to invest and have a long-term horizon around that.
I mean, look, I'm an Orioles fan. I've seen the worst and now the best in player development. The Orioles have no homegrown starting pitchers since Mike Mussina, basically. So things have changed a lot since Mike Elias and Sig joined the organization, and I can attest to that. But Jeff, I will say that I think, what's funny is I wrote down some of these like long-winded questions I wanted to ask, and then of course I went off script and I don't know why I went off script, but I ended up going off my own script. And then Yeah, and then I got lost there. But I thought that was fantastic. I think what Eno said about if you have a guy that's making a lot more than the other guys, that being difficult, I've always kind of thought that. I was like, what must it be like? Because, I mean, I think as humans, we have this notion of fairness that's important. It's the same reason why, you know, if somebody, your neighbor cheats on their taxes and you don't, you feel like you feel hurt by that, right? Somehow. And
is it fairness or is it because everyone thinks in relative terms, which is like
it's relative.
You
read terms, right?
Have you read Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely?
Of course. Or is so Dan Ariely, did he, there's, well, did he end up, was he faking the data or was it the other people?
I don't know. I'm not disparaging anyone, but there's a chapter at the beginning of where they talk about this guy getting a job in finance and, you know, after a few years, making a few a few hundred thousand dollars, being completely happy. And then finding out that someone he started with who he thought was worse than them was making more money than he was. And all of a sudden he wasn't happy anymore. So this notion of like relatives speaking, and then I did also write that down, this chemistry argument, because I remember one time I talked to Billy Beane about this chemistry thing, and he would joke about, you know, when's the last time you saw a really shitty team and you were like, oh, but they have great chemistry. I mean, and then I, you know, what I liked about this interview, it just made me think a lot about just not just sports, but in general terms, right? If you pay someone at your company a lot of money, they better be the person that has the right values, that works the hardest, that, delivers the most, that is well respected. And yeah, and ultimately, like, why wouldn't you do the exact same thing in baseball if you're the Padres and you're giving money to people potentially that don't embody the culture you'd like to represent, or maybe that is the culture you'd like to represent. But it's like, what do you value? That the lessons from sports to me, especially from like analytic sports people that transfer to business and life, are pretty fascinating. So I wrote that one down too.
I think that's a great example. Yeah. And by the way, I want to bring this to sports betting really quickly. You know, the whole sort of bad beat refunds, I think those are a net negative. And I think Matt Metcalf made this argument to me, and it made a lot of sense that it's a net negative because people then expect these. They're like, oh, this other person got this refund when this player got injured. I want my refund when this other guy gets injured that I bet on. And so it ends up, you know, people feel like it's not fair that they didn't get it. And so, you know, books spend money marketing, but they end up actually just making everybody pissed off.
Yeah, agreed. All right. Well, that's our episode for this week. We'll talk to you guys all again next week. We're having Cade on next week. Is that right?
Yeah, we're going to have Cade to discuss the NFL draft and how things have changed since his sort of groundbreaking seminal paper with Richard Thaler from almost 20 years ago now.
Nice. All right. Well, that's exciting. So we'll talk to you guys all again next week. In a simulated system that break down the data analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line is watered down. It seems like they don't get it. Puppeteers are but the engines running off a leaded. None of it's organic. It all sounds synthetic. That's why I fucks with Jeff Ma and his dog Rufus. No locks of the year. They just tell you what their truth is. Maybe make your pockets fatter as the bookies get thinner. Give the information, turn the losing bettors into winners. Yeah. Sperm Herm, reppin' Rutgers, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, crunching all the numbers, Massey Peabody rankings, we're looking for the edge, analytically driven, crunching all the numbers.